Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. We are starting a new channel dedicated to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I am your host, Wen Stenger. My pronouns are they, them. Some of you may know me as the CEO of Omni Inclusive, a certified, sustainable, and inclusive staffing and consulting firm. And many of you know my passion for inclusion and workplace belonging. In this DEI channel, I want to connect with other leaders in the movement towards workplace equality and talk education, barriers, and strategy. I'm so excited to kick off our very first episode on DE&I and welcome our guest, Sebastian Nemec. So it's a little bit about Sebastian. Sebastian Nemec is a life coach, speaker, and author on a mission to help LGBTQ plus people build queer wealth through entrepreneurship. To do this, he founded Coach Bastion LLC in 2021. Sebastian has served 10 years in the Minnesota Army National Guard from 2011 to 2022. He enlisted when he was 17 years old, right after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was repealed. And Sebastian shares his story as an openly transgender soldier in With Honor and Integrity, Transgender Troops, in their own words, which was published in 2021. Sebastian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm so excited to get this conversation going. So to get us started, tell us a little more about you and what brought you to become a career coach for others.
Yeah, so like you mentioned in my lovely introduction, thank you for that. I'm a life coach, speaker, author, and I got into coaching. It was kind of around a New Year's resolution time. And I was looking at ways. I always wanted to have my own business. I knew that. I have a degree in culture entrepreneurship. And so I was looking for ways that I could start even a side business and ways to help the queer community in particular. And I can't even remember what I was Googling, but Googling around New Year's going into 2021, and life coaching came up. And in the past, I didn't think much of it. But this time around, something was hitting different with it. And I was like, this is the direction I need to go. But I was in an online MBA program at the time. And the reason I was in the MBA program is really because it felt like the next logical step of, okay, I have a bachelor's in entrepreneurship. I want to have a business. And if a business doesn't work out, I want to have another avenue to make more money. And so MBA sounded like the next step. And as I was going through the program and looking at job opportunities for after I graduated, honestly, my heart just kind of sank. I'm like, this isn't the path for me. These things aren't aligning. For some reason, my gut is saying no, but I'm continuing to take my courses because it seems like then what else am I going to do? But then when I found coaching, it was like, this is where I meant to go. And then I found a very particular program that really spoke to me and ended up leaving my MBA program after the second term and going for a life coach certification. And 6 months later, I got my certification and it was the best decision I've made. And since then, I left the military this past January 2022. And as you mentioned, I served 10 years and about half that I was open as a transgender soldier. And before that, I was openly queer. And all my life experiences leading up to this point really just has helped me with my coaching and particularly the LGBTQ community.
That's just fantastic. I love hearing that story and love hearing how you followed your authentic path, even though you were trying to go down. I think so many of us go down that path of we're told this will be good for us in business and career. And then you go, but I really want to do this. I just think that's fantastic. And as you mentioned, your time in the military, so you and I both served in the military and we served during very different times. While I was active duty during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era, and you joined after the policy was repealed. Now, my experience was as a not out gay individual, and many of my friends as well. I always jokingly say, you know, the two gayest places in the world during Don't Ask, Don't Tell were the Air Force and the Navy. We were everywhere. We just couldn't talk about it, and we couldn't be who we are. We had to hide ourselves. So I experienced that life of kind of blending in and assimilating. And then you joined in a military environment after that was appealed and you could be your authentic self. So can you share what it was like being out and transitioning while in the military?
I was very fortunate with the people, my leadership, the people around me, my colleagues. And as a bisexual woman, when I joined, masculinity is a lot more accepted in the military than femininity. And so being bisexual, having short hair, and appearing as like a lesbian or queer woman, and just because of how I dress more masculine, it was okay. I didn't get any grief for that. And also growing up in Minnesota and being a part of the Minnesota Army National Guard, I think also helped, because Minnesota in general, I would say, is more accepting. And then when I realized I was trans a couple of years later, I was actually getting ready to deploy. And I deployed and without being open. I was open with some people, but obviously it was still not okay in 2014, 2015. You could still be discharged. And I met people online that had been discharged and was fortunately linked up with a group called SPARTA, a transgender military advocacy organization that spearheaded the repeal of the transgender ban. But after I got home from my deployment, I was like, I need to do this for my own mental health. I started medically transitioning, and being in the National Guard and not being full-time in the National Guard, I was able to do my medical care. Well, you have to do it on the civilian side for National Guard. And so I just kind of did it in the background. And I told my boss, who I deployed with, after I started hormone replacement therapy, because my voice is going to drop, there's going to be some of these changes, and it was going to be more obvious. And when I told her, the first thing that she said to me was, "How can I support you?" And so that was huge. And that's also after we deployed together. So we built a relationship for over a year. And then since then, she was a fierce advocate of mine all the way up to the chain. For military folks, when I say up the chain, I'm talking up to colonel level in the beginning, and then up to like 1-star, 2-star general level. Because then after I graduated from college, I became a full-time technician, which essentially it's kind of like active duty. You just don't get the same pay, but I still got to wear the uniform, go by the same rules. And I worked with generals in the state of Minnesota, including the adjutant general, who is the leader, one step below, of the governor of the Minnesota National Guard. And I received nothing but support from them. There's only one person I can think of in my whole military career that was presenting any obstacles. And then that person was essentially squashed because of the fierce support. And what is amazing now is that 2-star general, as public affairs, that was my job in the military, taking pictures, traveling with some high-ranking officials. I traveled with the 2-star general, General John Jensen at the time, and the governor, after a state activation because of a bunch of snow in southern Minnesota, so the National Guard was activated, and General Jensen actually asked me if it'd be okay for him to introduce me to the governor to put a face to trans service. And I said yes. And so I met Governor Tim Walz, and as a essentially a representative of what trans service looks like. And I knew Tim Walz is a Democrat and is supportive and all that stuff. And so there wasn't any worry there, but it was that gesture was huge. And what I love now too is now Major General Jensen at the time is now a Lieutenant General. So he's 3-star and is the director of the Army National Guard. So for the whole Nation Army National Guard, and to know that he supports trans troops and has supported them even during the Trump administration is amazing.
That is fantastic. It's just, it is amazing to see where allyship comes these days. And I, you know, I want to go back to, you know, what you talked about earlier in your career is I absolutely agree with you. Like the idea of being a masculine female in the military was very applauded. And so exactly to your point, I've talked about that before with my experience, us females who had a bit more masculine traits, it was considered good because you're in the military and the military is supposed to be masculine. It was my male colleagues who had more feminine traits that were targeted and had to hide a heck of a lot more. I am fortunate that I personally didn't get a lot of that discrimination, but seeing the unequal treatment, and the idea, to see now, you know, a military very different than the one that I was in, being so supportive, lifting up LGBT and trans voices in the military, you know, making those introductions to governors and. That's just fantastic. I love to see how, you know, it's a good example of how organizations can change, how they can change their perception, how they can change how they treat their staff. I mean, while military, we're a little bit more involved than just being an employee, a W-2. It's still employment. and kind of with that, so let's move forward and talk about. Intersectionality. So we talk a lot about intersectionality and diversity and inclusion. And many of our listeners today they're responsible for workplace management. They're HR managers, they're business owners, they're entrepreneurs, they're staffing companies. With that audience in mind, what do you want them to know about the importance of intersectionality and belonging?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is we are all at intersections without even realizing it. And it might not even, some of the things that we might think of as intersectionalities, ideas and categories are typically things to do with race, even sometimes ability, but sometimes people don't think about ability and disabilities, and then LGBT. And with being in HR, not all of that is tracked. And so even in the military, that was something that was difficult. How do you track LGBT people? Because it's not a question that's asked unless it's an added question. A lot of like the required questions have to do with race and ethnicity. And sometimes, I don't even know age sometimes, but queerness isn't always tracked. And if it is, they don't always have a box for everybody, especially transgender folks. And so I think what's important to think about in terms of intersectionality and belonging is you don't always know someone's identities and the intersections and what is at those intersections. For example, POC folks who are also queer or trans, they have different experiences and different layers of oppression than like I do. As a white trans man. And even now it's like, if an employer looks at me just for face value, they don't know I'm queer usually because I'm what's quote unquote passing or how I like to call cis assumed. People don't realize I'm trans. They don't realize I'm gay or bi. And so you never know what people's identities are and they aren't always tracked, but they still matter. And we need to figure out how do we include all of these different identities and the things that come with them into our culture. And it's not an easy thing to do. That's why there's DEI departments. And that's why there's people that dedicate much of their life to this work because it's important, but it's also not black and white. There's a lot of gray area. And so there's going to be mistakes, but as long as people learn from them, you can make a better environment, better culture for your company and have better recruiting efforts. So when you bring in these people that are marginalized, typically in society, they can still fit into your culture and enhance your culture and not want to leave because you have a bad one.
Absolutely. Well, and to your point, I mean, it absolutely is, you know, the idea of thinking that you can identify someone who is in a diverse or a marginalized community. I love that you bring that up because I'm in the same boat where I have an appearance where I can pass pretty easily without anyone asking questions. They don't know that I'm a queer non-binary person. I look like a straight cisgender woman. if you're open to talking about it, I'd love to understand, did you once the transition, did you notice a difference in treatment? Because to your point, you know, you without someone having a conversation with you, I don't think that they would know that you're trans or that you're queer. Like you do pass as a straight white man. What was your experience of treatment from female to trans man? You know, did you notice a difference? I mean, I think you've been really blessed with the military, but it'd be interesting to notice a difference in treatment, work, you know, workers, coworkers, places.
Yeah, so I think I've been intentional with where I choose to work. The military has been a bulk of my employment for full-time outside of being a student. Otherwise, like my first job was at Menards. So people that are in the Midwest know what it is. But if you're not in the Midwest, it's like a Home Depot or a Lowe's, something like that. And then I was more of a masculine bi woman. Mm-hmm. Although at that time I probably looked like a lesbian. And so bi erasure, that's another thing. Yep. And so that was fine. And then I was a barista, and many queer people are baristas. And so that was fine too. And so the area that I noticed the most difference, and it wasn't even as blatant, is something that I kind of started to notice, was I was listened to more. So even in my undergrad, when working as a student leader, just going through my major, making new connections, and then throughout all the other areas of my life, I realized that people just listened to me more. And that's something that we know is an issue, is that women are typically talked over, they're interrupted. And so that's even something that I've had to consciously make sure of, is because people are listening to me more, that I am not interrupting, because it's so... Yeah. Now it's like one of those things I've gotten used to. And so I have new privilege with that. And so how do I use that? How do I monitor that and make sure I'm not perpetuating these, I'm at a loss for the word, these things that are impacting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are impacting people negatively.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's we commonly refer to those as microaggressions, you know, the ability to, you know, when you're in a meeting and a female colleague speaks up that she's typically talked over or interrupted. And I mean, you bring up a really solid point. And as someone who, I'm female and live in a pure female, I found that I had to work really hard to get my voice heard. Work a lot harder to get my voice heard in the room. And I'm now in a place where my voice is mostly heard. I mean, I have no problem being loud, but you know, to your point of like, you start to become really aware of if you're talking over others, are you giving space for others to talk? And I'm a big advocate of that, is like, when you find your voice, make sure you're giving others space for their voice too, because man, what life would have been a lot easier if someone was giving me my space and I didn't have to fight. My psychology brain is loving the differences. And that's what I've seen too. In information and studies is typically when transitioning, when someone transitions from female to male, it is, they're seen more competent, they are listened to more, they're promoted more often. Whereas when we see individuals transition from male to female, then the treatment goes downward in the workplace, which I think is just, there's a huger conversation there about how we hold masculine behavior versus feminine behavior. It doesn't, like, yes, there's some gender in there, but there's even something that has nothing to do with gender there. It's behavior.
Expression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We really value the expressions differently in our society. And it's kind of weird how we do. And with that, you know, understanding the expressions, understanding the needs of the diverse population, we talk about, you know, the needs of diverse employee population when it comes to healthcare diverse. Often companies provide this one size fits all healthcare plan. And they think, you know, well, if this will work for most of our employees, so it should work for everybody. When in reality, you know, people are different. Like, find two people and see that they have the exact same stuff going on in their life. You'll never find it. You could find a set of twins and they still don't have the same stuff going on in their life. But my question to you is, you know, what kind of healthcare needs do the LGBTQ community have that cookie cutter healthcare plans don't accommodate?
Yeah. So whenever I look at a new healthcare plan, if I need to sign up for a new one, the first thing I look at is what are their transgender coverage options? And so that's looking at hormone replacement therapy. That's looking at how much surgeries are covered, what surgeries are covered. And a lot of the newer healthcare plans I've seen today, which is usually like Blue Cross Blue Shield, is that they call it what it is too, like a gender affirming care. And it's covered as it should be, because like hormone therapy isn't new. It's not a trans thing. Not even all trans people choose to do hormone replacement therapy, but a lot of people, women during menopause might need to do some hormone therapy. Some men do if their testosterone levels are low. And there's so many reasons why people might do that. But even beyond that, it's what about fertility and how people start families? And again, that's not just an LGBTQ issue, although a lot of LGBT people, that's the thing that they are looking for in healthcare as well. But IVF, a lot of plans don't cover it at all. I've seen plans where it's, they'll cover a $10,000 lifetime maximum. Do you know how much one round of IVF is? It's more than $10,000. And that's just for like the IVF part. That's not even all the prep for that. That's not creating embryos and finding donors. And so that makes it a big barrier for people to even start a family if they want one. Mm-hmm. And this could go into even bigger conversation now with Roe v. Wade and the things that are going to happen with that. But before same-sex marriage was even legal, when you have a spouse, okay, how do people become dependents on other people's plans when they're life partners? What about the kids? And then you have adoption costs, whether that's through doing IVF. There's so many components of it. So I think the biggest thing that people need to make sure that is included in their healthcare plans for their employees are hormone replacement therapies and gender affirming care. I would say overall, so that's the surgeries and the therapy, and then also fertility treatments. And then one thing I'm sure we're going to get into is mental health, because that's a whole nother side that really everyone needs, especially after this pandemic.
Absolutely. Well, and before we go on to mental health, I want to talk a little bit more about fertility care. I love that we're talking about this topic. And, you know, to that point with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, we've heard a lot in the media, you know, we've heard in our community that, you know, fertility rights, abortion rights, fertility care is an LGBTQ issue and healthcare need as well. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that. They don't think about the LGBTQ community when you talk about abortion or you talk about fertility. You know, I would even say, you know, I think I've heard before, you know, when you have a same-sex female couple, I think people are surprised to find that some of those women are still on or choose birth control. Birth control, while yes, it prevents birth, it also regulates hormones. It regulates hormones and it regulates, it prevents a lot of the reproductive issues that women can have. I have a lot of women in my family and people I know that have polycystic ovarian syndrome or endometriosis, and having a consistent birth control method helps regulate your hormones to where those things don't become a problem or you can keep them at bay. You know, I think it was 5 years ago was the first time I was finally on a healthcare plan that covered an IUD. And to have an IUD placed in your body without healthcare coverage is somewhere between $800 to $1,000 for that little bitty piece of plastic that hurts like a son of a when you have to deal with it. But the medical benefits that you get from things like that, and I think the general population just kind of thinks about birth control, fertility as having babies or not having babies, and it's more than that. I mean, how have you seen that kind of in your world as well? I think there's, I just think there's a topic there that nobody's talking about.
Definitely. Reproductive rights and healthcare are two things that I think especially trans people get erased from. Non-binary and trans men. People, it's not as uncommon as it used to be that trans men will carry their own children and give birth and be birthing parents. And a lot of the language that's out there is it's all about talking about women and women's rights, but this isn't just a women's rights issue. This is anybody with a uterus issue. And the issues that we're seeing today are not new either. There are things that BIPOC women have been dealing with for years before even Roe v. Wade and even during Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing for me is being erased from the conversation. And even sometimes you have to deal with healthcare, getting your insurance denying something because you might be like listed as male on insurance because yeah, you're male, you got your gender changed and everything, but then you need a pap smear still for health reasons. And then it's like, well, why, you don't need this. And so they deny it. And so then you got to get on the phone and then you risk people invalidating your identity there too.
Yeah.
Because you never know what someone, the customer service rep across the country is going to be thinking of you. And so are they going to use the right names? Are they going to use the right pronouns? What kinds of assumptions are they going to make? Mm-hmm. So there are just a lot of layers to it. And sure, it may not seem like a big deal. It's like, okay, you just need to call the insurance and get it figured out. It's like, one, I have a lot of other things I could be doing instead. Two, back when I wasn't passing as male so much and people would misgender me a lot more, I equated that to, it's like one person misgenders you, it sucks. Okay. But you go through an entire day of people misgendering you, it's like a bunch of paper cuts. One paper cut sucks. Two, three, yeah, that hurts. But what about 10 or 20 in a day? That's awful. And so when you're having people have to go and validate their identity, however many times, maybe it's not calling insurance or whoever multiple times a day, but every appointment, it's exhausting.
That's exhausting.
And dehumanizing. It gets to a point.
Very, very. And, you know, when we talk about that, you know, it, it kind of segues me into our subject on mental health, because when you deal with that all day and you deal with, you know, the, you know, not being seen and the invalidation and, you know, struggle to get the care that you need, get the services that you need. You and I both know that mental health needs of the LGBTQ community are really important. And many times people lack that access, just as you talked about. You know, the Trevor Project recently reported that 60% of LGBTQ youth who wanted mental health care over the past year were not able to get it. What I'd like to know, you know, what are some of the barriers to mental health resources, and what effects can that have on the community, the LGBTQ community worker population?
Yeah, I think the barriers to access, it depends a bit on where you're geographically located. It depends on your socioeconomic status and how much disposable quote unquote income you have, what age you are, because if it's youth, you can't just go and get a therapist. You are probably either under your parents' health insurance, state health insurance. Either way, your parents are going to find out. And what if you're part of a family that thinks therapy is bogus and it's doesn't do anything? There's a lot of communities that think that. And so, yeah, maybe you think you need it, but there's no one to help facilitate you finding a therapist. There's no one to help you pay for a therapist. And then as you get older, you're 18 and over. Okay, now you can go find a therapist without your parents knowing. Although sometimes if you're still on your parents' insurance until you're 26, they might still know. And so if you don't feel like you can be out about that with them, maybe you're thinking that you might be trans and you want to explore that gender and see what's going on there, and you want to do that with a professional, you might not want your parents to know that. And so the insurance issue and then the cost, some places have sliding scale, but not enough. And that goes back to the issue of, okay, why does therapy cost so much? Because therapists also need to be paid. They are usually like master's, PhD level folks. And then they aren't even usually getting paid enough, because then we have student loans. And so it's a whole systematic issue. There's so many different places that this is hitting. But I think the biggest barriers are that cost. And then if you're in a rural area, can you find a therapist, especially if you want to do therapy in person? There has been a lot more online resources that have been trying to make it more affordable, where it's like $90 a session, but $90 is a lot of money for one session. And therapy, you probably like to get the best experience out of therapy, you can't just go to one session. You have to go to multiple. And some people might need a year of therapy. How are you going to afford that? Especially if you're in your 20s. You're going to college. I think a lot of universities are doing a lot better now with offering some of these resources, like on-campus resources, and people are promoting it more. And the upcoming generation, I think, is a lot more, one, digital savvy, so they can find these resources better than even when I was a teenager. And then they're a lot more open to the idea of therapy, but it's still not a universal concept. Therapy is not something that everyone thinks they need. Some people might not even know what they could be going to therapy for. And so I veered a little bit from the barriers, but I think that there's so many layers to it to discuss. But the immediate ones are, I think, cost and access, like physical access. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, is cost and access. And when you look at a worker population, you know, companies go, you know, I think companies are starting to come around now, but companies kind of come to that, they came to that original decision of like, why is that my business? You just work for me. And, you know, what you do in your personal time is your own deal. But you, employer, are providing the healthcare. Most people in this country receive their healthcare from their employer. And it is a you get what you get scenario. There's unless you're with a really great large company that have, you know, package options. Sometimes there are many companies that this is the one piece of healthcare you get, and there's a little bit of mental health in there, but not really. You can choose to go, you know, to get affordable healthcare through your state. It is a lot more expensive than what you would pay from an employer. So that cost, you know, think about the cost of monthly healthcare from your local state process, plus the copays, to your point, you know, $90 an hour. What if you need to go weekly? And what if you need to go for years? That money really adds up. It's needed care. It's absolutely needed care. You know, from my experience too, I was actually fortunate in the military. They provided therapists, mental health therapists. I mean, not for anything to do with LGBT. That was the interesting thing, is I could talk to a therapist, and I had a therapist all through my military career, but I couldn't talk about that because then I would have been violating a don't ask, don't tell policy. So I couldn't talk to a therapist about that because they were military, but I could talk to them about anything else. And, you know, it's just, again, as the employer, what kind of healthcare are you providing? And we talk, you know, the work that I do is a lot in the contingent labor market. So these are contractors, whether they're short-term, long-term, project-based assignments. Employers, again, there start to think, you know, well, we don't really have to deal with their mental health because they're not our employees, or they're not fully employed. Well, they're employed by somebody. And being employed by somebody definitely means you got some, you know, doesn't mean that you're not going to have mental health issues or mental health needs. And exactly to your point, since the pandemic, oh my gosh, like the stress that people have been under, imagine being a contractor and your assignment is ended like that because the company needs to save money, and now you're struggling to find work. A lot of those folks struggled to find work for the past 2 years, and now we have a plethora of jobs because companies are hiring again. But those same workers have said, you know, we saw how you treated us over the past 2 years, so now I'm going to be more selective of the company that I choose. And that's, you know, people keep calling it the great resignation or the workplace shortage. I've heard the war on talent, which I think is ridiculous. So we're not fighting. No one's dying over getting hired. It's not a war. but you know, those things mattered. The companies that turned their nose to making sure that their employees were taken care of, health-wise, physically, mentally, emotionally, you know, that has a lasting effect. And a happy, wellness-centered employee is a productive employee, and an employee that you can retain a hell of a lot easier than nickel and diming something as important as healthcare. It's just such a fascinating topic that I think we don't talk enough about it. And only in the past maybe year or so have I seen, from a corporate perspective, our company is going, okay, I think we have to care about, you know, diversity and intersectionality and healthcare and mental health. And we suddenly have to care about those things that I think employees have been telling you for decades they wanted you to care about.
Yeah, it's interesting going from my military healthcare. I had some like active duty benefits. And then when I was a federal technician, I was on the federal employee health care, which is Blue Cross Blue Shield. That was the option I chose. And then now with my new day job, I'm on a different Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. But I was like, oh, this costs more. This sucks. Yeah. And so therapy with my old plan was a $20 copay. And so pretty manageable. And with my new healthcare, it's like, it's either going to be 30 or 50. Even the line was kind of unclear. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, so it's going to be more expensive. then a lot of other things are more expensive, just general healthcare. And so just because you have an employer sponsored plan does not mean that it's affordable.
Right.
And when I've seen a lot of stuff online too about like what workers are looking for, and a lot of companies, if they are being more competitive and more, I would say, better to their employees by doing 100% employer healthcare coverage, because some places it's like the employer still maybe has to pay half. And that's a lot more intriguing for workers who, like you said, oh, I have options now. And so why would I go work for a company that I have 14 days of PTO and I have, and that includes sick days. And yeah. Then I have to pay a $200 healthcare premium for this is also just my current healthcare is just me.
Right.
But I'm getting married later this year. We're going to have children in the future. Mm-hmm. Family plans are a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, that's why people also throwing in daycare coverage, thinking about that stuff. Even people will leave their jobs because it gets to a point that they have to pay to go to work because healthcare is so expensive or daycare is so expensive.
Yep.
And so how are you really supporting your employees? Because if you aren't supporting them in all these ways, like you said, they're going to leave. There's no benefit to them. And a company's mission isn't so important to a person that, especially a for-profit, it's not so important to a person that they aren't willing to leave for the betterment of their own physical and mental health.
Yep.
That's why people do like nonprofit and volunteering for the mission. If you're a for-profit company, it doesn't matter. You can have the best mission in the world, but if you aren't taking care of your employees, they're not going to stay.
Absolutely. Well, and as someone who, you know, my HR experience, I actually spent time in roles where I procured and maintained healthcare policies for the company. I can tell, and this is what I tell a lot of other buyers and HR professionals firsthand, that those gender affirming cares and mental health, when your broker provides you healthcare options, that is not part of the cookie cutter. You have to, like, you still in some cases have to ask for it. You ask for and say, hey, when you're reviewing your medical policies for your company, it's where is the gender affirming care? Where is the mental health? What are my options and what are the costs? If you don't ask those things, the insurance companies don't think to provide those because they're so used to not providing them. And I found that out. I was really surprised. And when I asked for those things, I found they actually didn't cost that much more. And some of them were actually, there were options where the price was the same. I just needed to ask for it. But did any of those insurance companies volunteer that information to me as the HR owner? You know, hey, if you want gender affirming care for your LGBT trans community, if you want to make sure that there's mental health, just ask us and we'll provide that. Hell no, they didn't tell us those things. So it's knowing what to ask.
That's a huge insight. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I thought, well, you'll just show me those options. And then when I said, where is this care? Oh, okay. Let me go get some of that and I'll bring it back to you in a proposal. I really think a lot of HR folks don't realize they have to ask for that care for their staff. Well, I am absolutely enjoying our conversation. Whether I provide post-educational articles or speaking engagements, I always like to give a takeaway for everyone. My point of having a conversation is, what can I give you as a takeaway to be a better ally? So I'm going to ask you that question. What would be your takeaway for our audience towards allyship?
Yeah, I think what I always tell allies is the best way to help is to listen and take action on what you hear. And so if you're a leader, HR professional, If your employees are saying, hey, we need this to feel safer, psychological safety is huge in the workplace, then work to provide that. I think companies, any especially large company that uses the excuse, well, we can't afford that, I call BS on. If you have an IPO, you can figure it out. Because that's what's the most important, is knowing that, for me, being an LGBT person, is knowing that I'm heard and that you're actually going to take action on what I'm saying to you. Because you can listen to us all day long and then be more performative and post on LinkedIn like, this is a really important thing. It's like, okay, but what are you doing behind the scenes? Are you ensuring that when you're shopping for healthcare coverage, that it's including gender affirming care and mental health coverage? And there's probably even some other facets. I'm not an HR professional, but I'm sure there's other things to look for other marginalized identities, probably short-term and long-term disability, especially for folks that are disabled. And we're recording this during Disability Pride Month. And so this is a great time to start thinking about some of that stuff and bringing it to front of mind. I mean, we should be thinking about this stuff all year, but when you don't hold one of these identities, it is harder to try and remember it. And so in curating connections, whether it's on LinkedIn or in your actual workplace, some people are still virtual or maybe going to be virtual forever. So LinkedIn and any other connections you can make through coworkers can be really beneficial in learning what you don't know. I think that's the biggest thing that people struggle with, is they don't know what they don't know. And how do you fill those blind spots? There's plenty of stuff that I don't know. And so I work to fill those blind spots by following people that I value their voice and their input on social media platforms. And when it's appropriate and it's, because you can't just ask people for all this labor for free either, remembering that. And so if maybe bringing in a facilitator, someone who does workshops for your group and paying them for their time, that's another takeaway. Pay people for their time and knowledge and experience.
For their time, absolutely.
I'll add that into the listening, taking action, and pay them.
I love that. Yes, that I love that takeaway. Well, I want to thank you again, Sebastian, for your time today. This has been a fantastic conversation. And we could go on forever, but I've loved being able to talk about military experiences, transitioning into civilian life and the needs of work of the LGBTQ community in the workplace. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.